charges, conspiracy, and piracy, making him the first person to stand trial for piracy in more than 100 years. Musset's attorney argued unsuccessfully that his client was only 15 and should be tried as a juvenile. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, New York.
A 9-year investigation found that thousands of Irish children were abused in institutions run by the Roman Catholic Church from the 1930s until they were closed in the 1990s. The report found widespread beatings, rapes, and humiliation. The commission also found that church and government officials did nothing to stop the abuse of these thousands of children in the school reformatories and orphanages. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Ally Bank, committed to straightforward banking. At allybank.com, visitors can compare bank rates all in one place with Ally's rate comparison tool.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. This morning in this hour of the show, we will explore the dynamic relationship between the rifle and America's history. And our guest is Alexander Rose. He's the author of a recently published book. The title is American Rifle, A Biography. It's published by Delacorte Press. And it takes a look at how the rifle changed over time, how the technology developed, moving from muzzle loaders to breech loaders to guns that would fire very rapidly to the kind of high-tech weaponry that's used by the American military today. It takes a look at how these weapons changed. It takes a look at what the changes meant for battlefield tactics. And it's quite an interesting book. Certainly, I would expect it would be interesting to people who are interested in guns and in military history, but perhaps also people who are interested generally in American history and the history of technology. So the book is out now. You can certainly take a look at it in the bookstore, perhaps also in the library. Our guest, Alexander Rose, was born in the United States and raised in Australia and Britain. He's a military historian, former journalist, author of Washington Spies, the story of America's first spy ring. His writing has also appeared in the New York Observer, the Washington Post, Studies in Intelligence, and in other publications. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Rose, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm glad to be on. Thanks for having me here.
Sure. Perhaps the first thing that I should ask you to do is to explain why a rifle is called a rifle.
Well, it's a very simple sort of explanation, and that is it comes from the word, it's a strange word, rifle, and it comes from the German verb, riffeln, to groove, and that's where. That's why you have in rifles, it's sort of defining characteristic is a kind of a helical groove cut within the inside of the barrel to make bullets spin faster and travel farther.
And so, and the advantage of the rifle over the other kinds of weapons that might have been common at the time, the smooth bore musket, which basically was just a smooth metal pipe on the inside, was that the bullet, the projectile, would spin. And this would give you greater accuracy at a greater distance than the kinds of weapon that would have been the common weapon of the military of the time.
Yeah, precisely. It's a bit like when a quarterback puts a spiral on a football. It just makes it to travel farther and travel truer in a way, whereas the musket was much larger calibered. And what you would do is you would just pour down some powder, and then you would essentially just roll a ball down it. And of course, as the ball is traveling up at about 800 or 1,000 feet per second after you've pulled the trigger, it sort of almost bounces along the inside of the barrel. So its angle after it leaves the muzzle is at whatever angle it last touched the inside of the barrel. So it could go pretty much anywhere. Whereas the rifle is much tighter. So the bullet grips the sides and that in part spin, and then it flies the way you want it to.
Yeah. So that's if you were that kind of matter is maybe not critical if you have massed infantry where what you're doing is you're putting out a hail of lead and anything that happens to be standing in front of it, it is going to be hit. But if you're, for example, if you're hunting and you have one shot and you really want to hit your target, then having a rifle gives you a tremendous advantage.
Yeah, you put your finger on the basic philosophical difference between the two different types of warfare in the 18th century, when a lot of this stuff was created, and that you have a single man firing a single bullet at a single target, usually from some distance away, as opposed to the proverbial hail of lead, which was when you lined up. It's one of those reasons why you have in 18th century armies, you have those very long lines of soldiers, and they all sort of point their guns vaguely in the direction of the enemy, and assuming that if what they're vaguely aiming at doesn't get hit, well, maybe a couple of guys down will get hit. So it's sort of firepower versus marksmanship.
Yeah. Well, the technology for making rifles was known in Europe and then came over to the United States. So certainly their rifles existed in Europe in the decades before the American Revolution. But American gunsmiths apparently gave this a particular kind of spin, or at least they developed a firearm that was unique to the United States.
Yeah, the rifle was known in Europe, and by that I mean it was really just restricted to a very small mountainous part of Central Europe, primarily in Austria, little bits of Switzerland, and in southern Germany. It was a very select audience of hunters. That's who used them in the mountains, which is one of the reasons why when their German gunsmiths emigrated to the colonies, the American colonies in the early 18th century, and set up shop around Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or in parts of Pennsylvania anyway, they were generally known as Jager rifles or hunter rifles, but they were a very different creature from what later became the quintessential American rifle, which is more famously known as a Kentucky rifle or a Kentucky-Pennsylvania rifle. The original German ones were sort of short and stubby and very, very heavy, whereas what the German gunsmiths did was that they made a hybrid with just a regular English-style musket, which is much longer and thinner. And so they created this sort of very lengthy, slender, light, gorgeous piece of weaponry that was aesthetically pleasing as well as quite lethal, and that became the Kentucky rifle. So that's why the Kentucky rifle is again an American instrument, whereas the Jager rifle was really kind of a tool of certain poor hunters, really.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question why it was that change happened, why it was that the gunsmiths, they had this particular way of making the gun. And we should, again, sort of remind people this was a time when this was a very specialized craft. It was something that not everyone could do. It was something that required a skilled artisan, somebody who made the weapon virtually from start to finish. So it took some time to make it. They were not cheap, and they were probably made to, I imagine many of them were actually made to order. What was it that you think might have led a gunsmith or these gunsmiths to make that kind of change in the weapon, in the pattern of the weapon, that gets us to this very distinctive and characteristic American version?
Well, chances are it was, again, a combination of geography and to use something of an anachronism, a customer demand. The customer was always right, even in those days in America. And, because they were in Pennsylvania, in Lancaster and points around there, Pennsylvania at the time was perched between its eastern seaboard civilization, most greatly represented by Philadelphia, which of course was I think the biggest city at the time, and then of course there was Boston, New York, and so on. And then to the west of that, you had what was essentially untamed, terrifying wilderness or frontier. And so where the gunsmith set up shop, hunters and travelers and scouts and Indians, various other wilderness types would stop in and pick up their ammunition and guns and so forth. And they were the ones saying, well, look, you know, if you make this, you know, if you tighten the groove on this or make the caliber smaller or you make it lighter and make it easier to carry through forests, then, you know, I'd happily commission one next time I'm coming through here. So it was really just, as I said, geography and customer demand. Mm-hmm. But one of the most famous people who commissioned his own rifles was George Washington, who at the time in the 1750s, 1760s, was a very young and ambitious officer who had fought in the French and Indian War and sort of knew a thing or two about wilderness fighting. And so rifles were ideally suited for that. And so he had four or five rifles commissioned for himself. And again, as you said, they were, these things were at least, you know, sort of 50 to 100% more expensive than even a good quality musket.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you look at in the book is how it is that changes in technology and in weaponry in particular, how they influence warfighting. And certainly that's something that we see again and again and again. And here, the case of the American Revolution is a particularly good example, because here we have, on the one hand, people who are suited for and equipped for a kind of guerrilla-style fighting up against a European army that's used to fighting in a very different way with this sort of massive infantry with weapons that aren't maybe particularly accurate, but if you get enough of them together and you point them in the right direction, whoever happens to be standing in your way is going to get torn up. Can you say something about how it is that the fact that we had, at least some people had these particular weapons, might have influenced the outcome of this war?
That's a very interesting question. I'll just turn to the technology part very briefly. We can talk about that later, or maybe someone else can bring it up if they're interested. Technology does influence war, but also war influences technology. I'd just like to sort of make that clear. But you can't get too much into sort of this materialist view of technology and war. About the American Revolution, the American rifleman played a minor but very striking role in the revolution, especially at the very beginning. They were used when Washington was besieging the British around Boston in 1775. He basically called out for riflemen to come help him, and so he was joined by several hundred rather rough and somewhat dubious types from Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, and Virginia, and Maryland, from the border reaches of them, and they came along and they were they basically buttressed army morale, which was then in the pits, and they would give shooting exhibitions, and nobody ever seen this kind of excellent marksmanship before, and they would dress as Indians and they would scout around and take British sentries prisoner. It was all sort of a morale booster. The problem with the as they found with the riflemen is that they were as difficult to discipline as it was like herding cats for these guys. I mean, they just didn't listen to any officers. They didn't wear a uniform. They weren't subject to any kind of army discipline. And so after a while, they began becoming much more troublesome than they were actually worth. And so Washington begins to swing towards the Continental Army, and which was he wanted to base on the British Army, the British Army's discipline and the training and arming of them. So American riflemen sort of started off strong and then weakened. Though during the course of the war, they became very useful in certain battles if they were deployed properly. Then that was what the key generals learned, that they had to be put into specialized units and they had to be given certain tasks. But the real fighting was left to the regular army, and so this became a major division in American military history. I think over the course, going over several hundred mm-hmm. years, even to today, really, where elite units like Delta Force, SEALs, and so forth regard themselves almost as a breed apart from the regular U.S. Army and other units. I think it's an old Mark Twain line about history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. I think it's Mark Twain. I'm sure someone out there in NPR land can correct me.
Yeah. Well, that's it's interesting that as you say, that when Washington came to trying to set up and equip his army, he was interested in having a regular army, and certainly he didn't have in mind those people would be armed with rifles. He wanted them all fitted out with muskets. And as you say, there seems to be this interesting kind of argument that has gone on virtually in the military since. The two poles of the argument being, do you want on the one hand a weapon that is very accurate but may also require great skill on the part of the marksman, and are you willing to settle in exchange for a slightly lower rate of fire, or do you want something that almost anybody can use with relatively small amount of training, something that something that has a high rate of fire, and you're willing maybe to sacrifice a little bit on accuracy to get more firepower. That kind of argument apparently still goes on in the military, and it goes all the way back to the Revolution.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I'll try and answer the question properly. During the Revolution, you have this conflict between these are American officers who almost wished that the Continental Army would fight along accepted civilized European ways, whereas then you have this other school of sort of almost ultra Americans who said that they wanted the people to fight, and that that meant that you have to lose a lot of the army's discipline that you got with the European style armies, which in the European style armies, the only way you can make your musketry work, and by that I mean when you line up the troops and you have them fire all at the same time, to create that wall of metal hurtling towards the enemy, is by absolute officer led discipline. Very very ferocious. Martial punishments. You have to conceive of the soldiers in your army as automatons. They're just there to do the job. They can be easily replaced. They're not given any or very little training. They just have to be able to march in line and to fire when they're told to. Mm-hmm. They're not supposed to actually think. And so you get people like Alexander Hamilton and General Anthony Wayne, or Mad Anthony Wayne, who believe that kind of talk. They were bitterly opposed by people like Jefferson and several other officers, like Daniel Morgan, even Washington himself sometimes, in that they said, look, that's okay in Europe, but in America we have to do things a little differently. We have more freedom here. So a rifleman, because he operates alone or in very small squads, is much more independent. He needs to spend hours or months training and honing his skills, because it's not an easy thing to do a shot at 400 yards. And he also, he must have immense self-discipline. He must have coolness under fire. He must be able to, importantly, he must be enterprising, be able to think for himself. And that's the basic philosophical division, which again, resurrects itself. In terms of gun technology, I'll just give you an example. Today, you have, the famous or infamous AK-47, the Kalashnikov, mm-hmm. which I think most people have heard of since it was invented just after the Second World War, was invented to arm unlettered and ill-trained Russian conscripts. That's what it was for. You were just told to pick it up and fire it in the direction of the enemy. You didn't have to think. So it was, you were basically sprayed and prayed. And that's one of the reasons it was given to it's often distributed to conscript armies, sort of low-grade militias, drug operators, people who don't really have a military type of discipline and training to allow them to shoot straight. Whereas the U.S. Army has always prided itself on precision-made, very accurate weapons. And so the M16, which has been in service since Vietnam, rather famously or notoriously, again, some people dislike this, it won't let you fire on full automatic fire like an AK-47. You have to take a couple of shots at a time, and that means you have to practice and put your shots where you're targeting them, where you have to shoot what you're aiming at, and that means conserving ammunition and not just letting it fire all over the place. And again, these are concepts that come down to us from during the Revolution, where you have this division between the rifle and the musket. I mean, these weapons are much symbolic of much more than just something that you use to kill people. They represent entire mentalities or modes of thought and worldviews encapsulated in a bunch of bits of metal and wood.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Alexander Rose. He's the author of the book American Rifle, A Biography. It's published by the Delacorte Press. We have a couple of callers here who'd like to join in, and that is welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Caller in Belgium here, the community, not too far from us. Line 4, hello.
Hello, and good morning. A couple of points about rifle technology. You're absolutely right in that the grooving of the barrels was very important. Today we still use a musket. It's called a shotgun, and it has a very good effect. Just like you say, it shoves a wall of lead downrange, and it hurts people badly. But the rifling, what really made rifling work so well is not the fact that it put grooves in the rifle. It's that you learned to spiral those grooves. So it was a spiraling action, thereby adding a gyroscopic action to the bullet that made it also run much truer downrange. But getting to the M16 that you just mentioned a minute ago, they put a little twist on that action in that they overpowered the slug that went down. They put a lot more explosive power behind it, and the slug that was in the bullet, the bullet itself, was slightly off-center. So it went down range very accurately, but when it hit its target, it tumbled, and it gave a much more massive injury.
Yeah, can I address that? The first thing is that your point about shotguns being modern-day muskets is actually one of the most brilliant things I've heard, and I really wish that I had thought of that myself and put it into the book. So I'm going to cannibalize or plagiarize your idea, if I may, and put it into the paperback edition.
Cool.
So thanks very much, caller, for that. The second thing is that I address the ballistics and ballistical coefficients and pitches and yaws and bullet design and so forth in the book, especially again of the M16 and going many hundreds of years back and how it changed and calibers and torque and cylindrical design and all that sort of stuff. But that's for us ballistic nerds to talk about. But again, I try and keep off that a little bit in radio and TV because people tend to lose the plot. So, but yes, if you're interested in that sort of thing, I do talk about that a lot in the book, and I find it absolutely fascinating. But again, thanks a lot for that shotgun point.
Sure.
And I suppose the issue about what happens to the projectile after it leaves the weapon and then hits the target, and I guess we shouldn't forget that what we're talking about is a person. The idea is, I think over time also what weapons designers have tried to do is to find some way that an increasingly smaller projectile will do more damage, because I suppose a lighter bullet means ultimately a lighter gun. Perhaps also that means you can get greater range. And for a variety of reasons, I suppose the smaller you can make the bullet, the better off you are.
Well, the smaller the bullet, the more you can carry. That's one benefit. I talk about this a lot in the book about different calibers and how important these tiny little differences between a .303 and a .300 is actually quite an important difference. So to the outside eye, it's almost imperceptible. But essentially, for hundreds and hundreds of years, it was always quite intuitively and I think naturally assumed that the bigger the bullet, the more damage it would do. I mean, I think that makes quite a lot of sense. And also, the faster you could boost it. So the more gunpowder you used and the bigger the bullet, basically the more dead the guy would be at the receiving end. And what they found, but it was always very confusing why rifle bullets would often which were smaller caliber than musket bullets, would always almost seem to be deadlier. I mean, they would do more damage than one would think, inflict more trauma. What happens is by about the 1890s, you have something called the invention, or the smokeless revolution, as I call it, and that's the invention of smokeless gunpowder, which is you need to use much less of it than you would have regular black gunpowder, but at the same time, it's 10 times more powerful. It's really an incredible. It's almost like a huge, almost atomic leap forward in terms of gunpowder technology, and that changes everything in terms of bullet design. And suddenly, you can have the problem is you can't have large bullets when you're dealing with smokeless powder because you'll blow up your own gun. That's that powerful. You just destroy your own the breech and chamber and so on. So what happens is they have to start minimizing or reducing very quickly the bullet calibers. From the standard in the late 19th century for a single-shot weapon like the Springfield, which is the Army issue one, was about, a 45 caliber, and it went down to about, a 30-06 or a .30 very quickly. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge and significant difference. But what they were finding was that quite often these bullets would inflict much more trauma and wounds on the victims than before, which was again completely counterintuitive. Why would this be? And essentially, the answer. But again, as the caller mentioned before, the early M16 bullets were incredibly traumatic. I mean, and they were tiny bullets compared to even the late 19th century or early 20th century ones. And it was incredible. The reason being is that they would fly straight, but they were designed to split apart and fragment inside the human body, and they would cause immense damage. It's a rather gory sort of subject to talk about, but it really is actually quite fascinating that how bullets actually work. Even with these great advances in bullet technology or killing technology, you also have great medical advances. So even today, the number of deaths caused by bullets is much lower than it was 100 years ago. Quite strikingly so.
Let's talk with another caller, someone in Decatur on line one. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. Just a couple of comments, observations. Perhaps your guests want to comment. I'm old enough to remember a TV show in the 50s, 60s with Chuck Connor called The Rifleman. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the claim to fame there was the repeating rifle.
Yep.
And with the tactics of war, of course, it seems that the technology is always one step ahead of the tactics. And I would imagine that the repeating rifle was just, as opposed to the single load, it was just probably just absolutely devastating. But the comment I had was I was wondering, again, not to cite the movie, but a movie with Michael Caine called Zulu, where they had
the
single repeating rifle, but they formed, I guess, what they call a British wall, whereas the first column was reloading. It was always seemed to be always a steady stream of fire being in
a good officership for you.
Yeah. And then finally, I always get this conversation with my father-in-law. He said in battle, you guys are talking about injuries, he said it's always better to wound your man than to kill him outright, because if you have a wounded guy, you're basically tying down two or three more people on the field. And, again, this is just a tactic. So just wondering if you wanted to comment on any or all of that. Thanks.
I agree with you that Zulu is a terrific film. I think it was Michael Caine's first role, I think. About the wounding versus killing, yeah, I think that's quite an old sort of rule of thumb, and that if you wound someone on the battlefield, then you tie up their medical and logistical services. You need two guys or at least one guy to take the wounded victim back behind the lines and so on. That's a good point. I think I always thought that in the heat of battle, though, I don't think that the soldiers really think like as rationally as that. I think they just they're usually quite scared, so they just sort of, fire. And if they happen to wound or kill the guy, that's great, so long as he's not firing back at them. And I can't quite remember the other point. Oh, but the repeating rifle is quite an that's a fascinating story about repeaters. versus single-shot rifles. And that I devote a couple of chapters in the book to that in the late 19th century because, again, that represents the there was a huge decades-long fight between military and civil authorities over whether the army should be armed with single-shot rifles, which, again, forced you to be a good marksman and and conserve your ammunition and be disciplined and so and be self-disciplined as opposed to repeaters, which to tell you the truth, actually, which were regarded as being wasteful. They were regarded as the AK-47s of their time. To tell you the truth, again, counterintuitively, early repeaters really weren't that devastating. The reason being is that the actual act of repeatedly and quickly reloading your rifle created a huge amount of heat and stress on the parts of the weapon, and so you had to have much smaller bullets, and so they were always regarded as being underpowered. They were thought to be almost like wimps guns, to tell you the truth, and they were looked down on for decades as the kind of gun that an amateur takes. So the army stuck by its good old single-shot 45s with which Custer and his men went to their deaths, which could only fire one bullet at a time and had to be hand-loaded, one bullet, in order to conserve ammunition, as opposed to, as all these sort of city boys who were going out west to go to the gold rushes and so on, who all of whom bought Winchester repeaters because they were really easy to use, and the fact is that if you missed once or twice or three times, you could probably hit the guy with the fourth one, even if it were at close range. So there's a very long debate about that. It took until the 1920s before the military authorities really reconciled themselves to the fact that we need to have a gun that has five or six bullets in reserve in a clip. So it's a very interesting story, and again, a lot of it's sort of counterintuitive. The repeater wasn't quite as devastating as one would assume.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Alexander Rose. His book is American Rifle, A Biography. It's published by Delacorte Press and takes a look at the history of the rifle throughout the history of the United States and how the technology changed over time. If you're interested, you can head out to the bookstore or library, look for the book. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
Can I just add a self-advertisement in there? Sorry, I apologize for this blatant self-publicity. You can also check out my website, which is www.alexrose.com. You can do that before you head out to the bookstore if you'd like.
Very good. No, I have no problem with you mentioning that. I think the development of the repeating rifle, the Henry rifle, and then the Winchester that mm-hmm. came after that, I think is interesting, striking that the stability of these guns, the Winchester particularly, really notable in the sense that here we have, I'm sure that people after the Civil War, as they headed into the American West, they took a lot of different weapons, but there were perhaps two things that were really iconic. One would be the Colt single action revolver in the 45 caliber version known as the Peacemaker, and the other is this Winchester that essentially had the same pattern, the same design from the late 1800s up until the time relatively recently where they stopped making it. It was essentially the same gun. It seems to me that that's fairly remarkable that gun stayed the same, stayed very popular, and apparently was very relatively easy gun to use, easy gun to shoot, known as being shooter friendly and pretty accurate. That's a long time for a weapon to stay unchanged.
Well, guns, you're quite right. I mean, guns almost stay the same for a very, very long time. In the book I talk about in the 18th, essentially you have a couple of different eras, and the first era goes from about the Renaissance until sort of 1840 or so, and that's when you just have these basic flintlocks, or percussion rifles as they later became. But again, the very traditional sort of muzzle-loading sort of instruments. So again, someone firing a gun in 1820 could have easily have used one from 1680 with a little bit of practice. Not a problem at all. Or someone from vice versa, someone from 1680 could have worked out how to use an 1820 gun with just a, you know, 10 minutes, you know, 10 minutes practice. From about the 1830s, 1840s onwards, until about the time of the Civil War, it sort of got truncated by that, you have what I call the technological Big Bang, and that for a variety of reasons, which, again, I outline in the book, you have this almost an explosion of weapons technology that changes, that revolutionizes rifle design. And those changes include things like metallic cartridges, or, you know, what basically you think about as a modern bullet, and that you have a tip, and then a bullet tip, and then you have that encased by a sort of metallic cartridge filled with gunpowder of some kind. Then you also have, you know, again, the impact of repeaters, which you didn't really have before. You have the rise of the breech loader, the domination of grooving, all sorts of things like that. You know, new types of sights, new types of designs, all sorts of things like that. And also, most importantly, you have the beginning of mass production. So for the first time ever, you're changing from sort of a craftsman's workshop making one gun at a time to factories making 20 or 30 of these a day, which makes of course a huge difference. And and then I think again that era, I think, is lasting until today, essentially. And again, in the last chapter, I address this about what's going to happen next. And my personal view is that we're coming to the end of the line in terms of this current era's ability to tweak performance of conventional guns with the traditional metallic cartridges and so forth. And that in the future, in several years to come from now, to make any big differences, they're going to have to use they're going to have to find a great leap forward, and that means sort of onboard computer technology, caseless rounds, new types of plastics used in rifles, all sorts of stuff like that. But again, that's going to be quite a long time in coming. But so we're reaching the end of an era now, which is one of the reasons it makes rifle design is an interesting moment right now.
It's interesting to go back to the point where you're talking about where particularly the government and the military were interested in a couple of things. They were interested in getting a weapon that had a higher rate of fire, but they also were interested in getting something that could be mass produced. And the muzzle loading musket or the muzzle loading rifle was not only was it slow because the process of loading it was sort of laborious and it took you some time and you could fire one shot and then you had to go through the whole process again. Yeah. But also it was an artisan item, and the production processes were slow. The guns from one maker to another might be different. They might use a different size bullet, so everybody had their own bullet mode and mold and made their own bullets. So that was not particularly practical for the military. What they were looking for was something that could be mass produced, could have interchangeable parts, something that was a standard weapon with all of the advantages that would come with having a standard weapon.
Absolutely. I focus on, I think in chapter 3, on one of the greatest American heroes, I think, but that only a guy you've never heard of, called John Hall, who was this rather plucky, cranky Yankee from Maine, who in the 1820s came up with a brilliant idea. Brilliant idea. I mean, nobody had ever really thought of it before about how to make a breech-loading gun, which, again, by loading at the breech or just above the trigger, you get to immensely speed up the amount of rounds you can fire a minute. You don't have to do the whole ramrodding, lifting up the rifle, packing the gunpowder down, screwing the ball down in it or anything like that. So you can raise firing rates from sort of twice a minute to 13 or 14 shots a minute, which again is a bit of a revolution. But he also realized his real brilliance lay in his idea that you have to, in order to standardize weapons and make and allow universal performance standards, you have to have machines making these machines. You cannot keep on having craftsmen or gunsmiths with 15-year apprenticeships behind them making rifles or guns as they see fit. Because what would happen is that you would have a gunsmith, and then he would be making rifles in a certain way, and of a certain length and a certain type of quality, and you know the woods he would use would be one type, and he'd use a different type of iron or steel, you know depending on his own whim and skills. And just, I mean, next door to him, you'd have another gunsmith who was making similar rifles, but they, you know, he would do it according to his own whims and talents. And so if you're an army ordnance colonel trying to acquire 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000 rifles, this is an impossible situation because you couldn't get spare parts. Each of these rifles was unique, even ones made by the same person. If, you know, if the screws came out, you had to have him make new screws, either that or you would have to sort of hammer in jerry-rigged screws, which, of course, when under the titanic pressures unleashed by firing bullets constantly, you know, these guns would just shatter apart. And so John Hall spent the next 35 years of his life or so working at Harper's Ferry, at the government armory, trying to design and make machines that would make perfect interchangeable machines. And that, by that I mean interchangeable means, which is a commonplace nowadays, but what it really means is that you can get 200 rifles, you can take them apart, you can mix up all the pieces, and then you can just put them back together randomly, and they'll all fit absolutely flush and perfectly. Again, at the time, that was regarded as the Holy Grail. Nobody could achieve that kind of perfection. Nobody. But Hall managed to do it after 35 years. The great irony is that by the time he actually managed to work out how to do it all, his own technologically advanced breech loading rifle was sort of out of date, so he sort of faded into obscurity and a rather bitter man. But he did leave behind a lot of mechanics and engineers he'd trained to do this, and they all went out and they later formed large machine tool corporations, bicycle factories, all sorts of things like that. That again led to the great industrial revolution in America. So John Hall is, I regard him as the sort of the Alexander Graham Bell of weapons technology, or the Steve Jobs of rifle design, and the Henry Ford of rifle automation or mass production. So he's quite a great guy.
There was a big change in technology between World War I and World War II. In World War I, the infantrymen, the standard weapon that they carried was a bolt-action rifle, the Springfield 1903 rifle. And then in World War II, the standard rifle that the infantrymen carried was the M1, which was a semi-automatic gun. What was the big advance, or what was the significance going from the Springfield to the M1?
The major difference between a bolt action and semi-automatic. Sorry about that. Is that with a bolt action, again, it's a relic or a hangover from the old days when you wanted to force soldiers to use single rounds at a time in order to take their time to hit their targets and conserve their ammunition. So you would fire and then you would pull the bolt back, and it would eject the round, and then you would load another one. This, I'm speaking generally now. There were various sort of wrinkles on that. Whereas with a semi-automatic, you have a clip or magazine, if you prefer, of a reserve of ammunition of 5, 10, 15, 20 bullets that you would load into the bottom of it, and every time you pulled the trigger, it would fire automatically. So really, that's again the return of the firepower school, and that you didn't really have to aim that carefully. You would just keep on firing ammunition. So that's the major difference. So again, you have that return of that pendulum between the school of marksmanship versus the school of accuracy. Firepower, mm-hmm. going back and forth.
You know, I was thinking about your earlier comment about the fact that existing technology has perhaps gone about as far as it can go, in Vietnam, the rifle was the M16, and that now American troops are using the M4. I don't know why we went back in numbers, why we didn't go to the M18 or something, but it's the M4, that to me, as an unschooled person, just kind of looks like a scaled-down version of the M16. So you're saying is that there's only so far that you can go making refinements in what exists. But I guess I find myself wondering that if you truly talk about something that's a vast leap in technology, that's something much more sophisticated, that has onboard electronics and things like that, my concern would be, yes, the more sophisticated it is, maybe the more whiz-bang things it will do, but also the more things there are in there that can go wrong. And I'm not sure that that's something that I want to take onto the battlefield with me, something that's really complicated, something that has many ways that it can fail, and something that's so sophisticated that I'm not going to be able to do anything about it if it decides not to work.
Yeah, what you're illuminating is a theme that recurs throughout the book. Just by the way, the M4 is almost like a stepson of the M16. It's the reason it's shorter than the M16. The reason it sort of took over almost by accident in Iraq. It was originally just supposed to be a sort of a plain Jane gun for support troops, never a combat weapon. The reason it took off in Iraq is because it's easy to get in and out of Humvees, whereas the M16 is much longer barrel. So guys jumping out of Humvees would sort of hit the barrel against the roof, or they would have to lean it on their friend's shoulder, which is, again, a little bit dangerous if you fall asleep. That's one of the reasons. But the I find the role of technology fascinating and very very intrigued by the way technology advances or doesn't advance. You know, what kind of technology gets adopted and what fails. Rather surprisingly, one problem I find with many history books is that there's a view that technology always advances, and that whatever is a superior or an advanced technology always beats the old technology, and that leads, of course, to all sorts of questions about, well, if somebody stands in the way of adopting this brand new advanced technology, as indeed you might with the if you were, say, an ordnance general saying, well, I don't want this brand-new computer-guided bullet gun in the hands of troops, because if something goes wrong, then, they're all dead. And the reason is, people like that are always regarded as sort of reactionary old fools, generals fighting the last wars and so on. And, again, that's completely untrue. I mean, there are very reactionary old generals around, but by and large, there are very good reasons to stick with what's old and traditional, and one of those reasons is that it just works. If anyone's ever had the pleasure of trying to install a new computer operating system, you'll often find that adopting new technology has malfunctions, it's got bugs, it crashes, all sorts of problems, and so you tend to stick with what you know best, and that just seems to work because all the bugs have been ironed out already for you. Technology, in a word, it can advance, but it also has evolutionary dead ends. It goes backward. It disappears. It fades into obscurity. It shudders to a halt. All sorts of things. It's a very it's almost Darwinian in a way. And again, one of the examples is what I was talking about is John Hall's super advanced breech loader, and that. At the time, you'd think, well, that's an amazing bit of technology. That should have beat out everything, every competitor. But instead, generals and soldiers stuck by old traditional muskets until the Civil War and beyond. And one of the reasons is that, Hall's thing, he just wasn't a good businessman, and he didn't have the right connections, and he also focused on building his machines rather than selling his wares. And so he lost out, and what appeared to be old or inferior technology stuck around for the 40 or 50 years because it just worked. And so, yeah, again, this is a theme throughout the book. I'm quite fascinated by it. Mm. The rifle today, we didn't have to end up here. It wasn't predetermined. It wasn't predestined in any way. It's just a series of accidents and decisions and flukes of history that we ended up with the shape of the gun that we have today. So that I have to. My job as a writer was to kind of bring a sense of that amazingness to the page.
We have a minute or two left. We have a caller here. I'd like to try to get in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? This is actually a very, very interesting subject. I was in the military 40 years ago, and I was in a recon unit, so I had experience with the M16 and the Kalashnikov and some of the sniper rifles and stuff. But I was going to go back to the musket because I had a chance many years ago to fire one. that'd be the equivalent of a Kentucky rifle. And I was really amazed at the accuracy of that weapon and the caliber of the bullet. I mean, you would not want to get hit by one of these things. It'd probably either blow your, it'd break a bone, probably break your femur. And so back then you couldn't set up a leg. But I, the only problem I had when I was in the military, I thought, that, well, other than the fact you shoot people, was the fact that, ammunition was, you had to carry, you're in infantry units or you're, we'd go on recons and we'd be gone for like 3 or 4 days. You always had to carry all the ammo with you. You weren't replenished by choppers or anything. So, thusly, you had to learn to not fully automatic. And I was going to say, I noticed that I read recently that the modern M16 does not have a fully automatic mode. Because of the fact that ammunition was expended too quickly, so you'd run out. And thusly, like you said, you'd be dead. You ran out of ammo. But I wanted to just mention that, and I'll look forward to your book. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We're just coming down to the point where we have to finish up, and there are a lot of things that we could not have talked about, but we have not talked about that we could have. A lot of history here that's between the covers of the book. Is anything in particular that you think is that we haven't mentioned that you think is just a nice element to leave with folks?
Well, I think quite briefly, as I know I've been droning on quite a lot, is that, you know, to my mind, American rifles and American history are like Siamese twins or conjoined twins, and that they're inextricable. You can't. One is but half of two. And I think it's a pity that quite often that, you know, for various political reasons, and which I don't deal with any kind of politics in the book at all, is that, you know, America, you know, rifles are regarded as a sort of a, you know, a thing apart, and that shouldn't be. That shouldn't be part of history. And in fact, they are. I mean, much of what you see around you today is actually created directly or indirectly by the rifle. I think that's just a sort of a coda to leave on.
All right. Well, the book, if folks are interested in reading it, is American Rifle, A Biography. It's published by Delacorte Press by our guest, Alexander Rose. He's also the author of the book Washington Spies, The Story of America's First Spy Ring. His writing has also appeared in the New York Observer, the Washington Post, Studies in Intelligence, and other publications. And if you'd like to look at his website, that's alexrose.com. Mr. Rose, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for Focus 580 comes from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with 4 area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the agricultural prices and what's going on at the marketplace at the mid-session. As we look at the charts, we see that there is still a lot of green on the screen, but prices have backed off the highs that we saw earlier in the day, especially in the nearby soybeans. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, July wheat is now trading at 652, up 9.25. It's been as high today as 659. December 675.5, up 8.75. At the Board of Trade, July wheat 596.75. It's been up 8.25 now at 597. It's been as high as 604.75 today. December 645, up 7.75. July corn 429.5, up 3.75. It's been as high as 434.75 today. September 439, up 3.75. December 450.5, up 3.5. It's been as high as 456. July crude oil 61.46 is up $1.36. June ethanol, 172 is up 9 tenths. The June RBOB at 185 8 tenths is up 4.5. July soybeans, 1169 3/4, now 1170 up 8. It's been as high today as 1189 1/2. August, 1134 up 14. September, 1067 1/4 up 16 1/4. November, 1018 up 22. January of 2010, 1020 up 22 1/2. And March at 1011 up 18. July soybean meal, 375.70 up 170. August, 359.70 up $4. July soybean oil, 33.48 up 31. August, 38.61 up 28. June live cattle, 81.52 1/2 down 15. August, 82.15 down 47 1/2. May feeders, 99.95 up 10. August, 180 down 57 1/2. June lean hog, 65.85 down 40. Ed Kieser's two-state forecast today reads like this.